This is International Insights, conversations with experts and entrepreneurs on principles of management and leadership, produced by Dr. Joe Shkembri from the Faculty of Economics, Management and Accountancy.
Welcome to International Insights, stories from the real economy. My name is Joe Shkembri. Big things really have small beginnings. Sometimes an idea, an imagined future, triggers the growth of an organization one step at a time, but in a march towards this vision. In today's conversation, we trace the history of one of the only multinational companies which started in Malta, Tolly Products, makers of cosmetic packaging for the global cosmetic brands. We discuss with Andy Gatesy how the desire to grow drove the company to become an international player in this sector, and how the COVID pandemic pushed the company towards more, not less, innovation. I'd like to take you back, you know, many, many years ago. You joined the company in 1986. The company was started by your father before that. But you've started an interesting journey back then. And you managed to attract, you know, top-tier companies eventually, but I guess at first it wasn't like that. Can you tell us a little bit, you know, what the main milestones were on a customer-facing front?
Okay, yeah. We actually started here in Malta. First year of manufacturing was 1971, so we're actually celebrating this year 50 years of manufacturing in Malta, which I think is a milestone for any company. I was just a kid. I was probably 5 years old when I came to Malta the first time. I went through a degree in engineering business school, and when I joined the business, as you said, around 85, 86, Tolly was at that time really an English company with a satellite factory in Malta. All our customers were British, Boots, Avon, their UK factory, Estee Lauder's UK factory, Rimmel, brands like that. And my dream was always to try and internationalize our business. I remember probably around 1986, we went over as a family to Paris for the weekend, and I went through Galerie Lafayette, and I saw all of these brands, these French brands. We didn't work with any of them, you know, Chanel, Lancôme, Guerlain, Christian Dior, Clarins. And I said, you know, we can work with nice brands, why can't we work with these brands? So in those days, the world was always much bigger. You know, it's not like it is today. So I said, well, how are we going to tackle that? We'd better start opening our own sales organizations. So we opened up in the US in 1987 with just a one-room office in New Jersey. Today, that's our biggest market, the US market. We did the same thing in Paris in 1989, then Benelux in 1994.
These were offices, sales offices?
These are sales offices. So we started, you know, working with the brands. As I said, in those days, the world was very different. You had to work in their local currencies. You had to speak the language. You had to be physically present. You know, today in the digital world, with the euro currency, for instance, a lot of that has changed. But I would say that was the start of our journey towards internationalization.
And you eventually managed to attract the global kind of names. How challenging was that? Because it's easy to say, like you said, you know, you went to the Lafayette and you said, listen, why don't you work for these big names? But, you know, between saying it and doing it, I guess there's a...
Yeah, no, it's a challenge. You need to have the credibility. I think we could prove that we could do good quality. We were competitive. Probably a milestone in our history was when we won our first contract with Chanel. And that was back in the late 1980s, around 1989. And they came to us, actually first in the US before their head office in France, and said, we just relaunched our packaging, but we have this unique process called UV lacquering. And in the West, nobody had heard of that process. So I said, what is it? They said, go to Japan and find out. So I went with my technical director to Japan. Okay. We went and we found the equipment and the process, and we invested. In those days, it was a $1 million investment. I remember it was the biggest investment we'd ever made. But it really changed our picture as a business, because suddenly, from being very good at replicating and almost Me Too technology, a bit like the Chinese, we had the state-of-the-art technology. There was nobody in the industry in 1990 that had injection molding and then lacquering at the same time. Then we started working with Chanel, and Chanel was one of the leading brands in the world, and it also helped us with our credibility. And from then we started working and adding more and more of the prestige brands, the legacy brands to our portfolio.
How important is it to work for a client like Chanel, who I would imagine is very demanding, you know, and kind of very sophisticated for building your capabilities going forward?
Yeah, I think you learn from all of your customers. They push you all the time, you know, new technologies, new systems, new processes. And I think we're in the beauty industry, but the beauty is becoming more and more closer to pharmaceuticals. So the standards are getting tougher, you know, more, tougher standards for manufacturing.
Well, I had an opportunity to come to visit your innovation center last week, and it's quite impressive. You're kind of co-producing solutions with the client. Has this kind of played, you know, a part, and is this kind of fitting with the latest trends in the industry, and why?
Yeah, for Tolly, innovation is really the currency of the future. So innovation is really, really important. Every brand asks us for innovative solutions, but it was very difficult for a brand to be able to demonstrate that. Why? You go into a store and you've got an innovative applicator or dispensing. How do you demonstrate that? You can't. As people have moved online with these new brands particularly, you know, they're posting videos all the time on Instagram, on YouTube, and you can demonstrate a benefit and innovation. So suddenly these new brands come to us, and all the innovation we've been doing, they're hungry for that, to be different, to be able to demonstrate. So they play directly into the strategy that we've created over the past few years.
And what's the offering with the Innovation Center? How does it work, really?
Well, we really encourage, you know, pre-COVID, we encourage customers to come and visit us, because when they came into the Innovation Center, they could sit down with us and partner with us on innovation. So they could have a challenge. Let's say they want to launch a new product. They want a solution for something. We can bring them in. And in our building in Malta, it's quite interesting, because historically we're an industrial player. Yeah. But today when you walk into our offices as a manufacturing business, we have makeup artists. We have beauty bloggers. We have trends watchers. You know, we're watching all the trends all the time. We have graphic designers. We're doing branding for our customers. We're a design studio. We have concept designers designing packaging for the retailers and the different brands, as well as the innovation engineers always applying for patents. But that's all supported by the technical and the operation strength and excellence of the business. So you can pull everything together in one center.
Thinking of clients and how to kind of generate leads, one thing I also wanted to ask you is, looking back when you started internationalization in the late 80s, the way you used to do marketing and generate leads back then, and how has it changed? You know, how is your organization different today?
It's completely different. I would say that a lot of the leads were probably generated from trade shows. You know, we used to do 12 exhibitions a year around the world, from, you know, all over the world. We
were just once a month.
Yeah. So some months nothing, other months two in a month.
Okay.
So, but that was from Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Monaco, Bologna, Paris, London, you know, just to name some of them. So we were busy setting up stands, connecting with customers, bringing them here to Malta. You know, the last 12, 18 months, all of that's changed because people haven't been able to travel. There's been no physical show. So we've had to quickly move online. And in fact, one thing that we did was, how do you present innovation to your customers when you can't meet them physically? A real challenge.
That's interesting.
So our marketing team, led by Dorian, was very clever, and they said, we need to move into this virtual world. Let's build an audiovisual studio, because the future is going to be video. And you've seen that online. When you start interacting with customers, you don't have to be physically there. It's moved to this online world. And to me, it's more powerful. Okay. Because when you go and visit, physically meet a customer, you know, you travel there, they might be traveling somewhere else, so half the people turn up, they have other meetings, they're busy. You know, you can't bring in your whole team, but online it's a different world. Most people are stuck at home.
Yeah.
Even today, if you go to the US, most people are still working from home. Mm. So they're much more present, and you can bring people from around the world into this meeting, and then you can bring in video productions into this meeting, okay. And it really makes a difference. So to me, it's very powerful.
But this means that a totally kind of new capability for a manufacturing company. Was it a bit of a switch in the way you operate?
Yeah, I would say we're not just a manufacturing company. We're really a business to support the brands. You know, the way that we work with our customers is completely different. And I guess that's a little bit our journey the last 50 years. You know, when I was a kid growing up and people ask my father, who is Tolly, he'd say, we're an engineering company. We build molds, we convert plastics. When he died in 1991 and I took over, we just invested in this lacquering process. So we were able to not just build molds and inject plastics, but we're able to create beautiful packaging. So I said, we need to become a packaging supplier, okay. Decorating and assembling. If I look back the last 5 years, as I just gave you the example, we've become a solutions provider to the beauty industry with all of these capabilities. Mm-hmm. And if I look forward again, it's going to change again. You've got to keep agile.
Where do you see it going in the next phase?
To me, it's about having customer-supplier partnerships.
Okay.
Really being able to partner with your customers. Why? Because they want speed-to-market solutions, so they want to be faster. They want innovation, so you need to partner with them and do these innovation workshops and find ways to have a win-win approach into the market.
Yeah. To do that, obviously, you rely a lot on relationship management. Is that something you do yourself only as CEO, or is it, you know, company-wide, essentially? And how do you do that?
Relationships with our customers. No, it's not just me. Our sales offices and our sales teams, we have VPs of sales. I have three chief commercial officers. They're interacting all the time with the customers. But for me, as a CEO, it's also important to meet customers. I think the most important things to me are to be present in the field with customers and with the people that you employ, because that's where you get the real market intel. How can you run a business? How can you look at where the industry is going, where the trends are going, if you're sitting in your little office and you're not communicating or integrating with the outside world? So to me, that's really important.
The COVID happened, you know, 2 or so years ago, and we're still in it now. How has it affected, you know, the marketing side, the sales side, and how has it changed the organization now that we're moving into hopefully a post-COVID reality?
Well, interestingly enough, our industry was always very resilient when it came to a crisis. I think Leonard Lauder, who was the chairman of Estée Lauder, coined it as the lipstick factor. He said, when the going gets tough, people go and buy a lipstick. But with COVID, that changed. Why? Because we're in the beauty business, so makeup, skincare, fragrance, and makeup is a big part of our business. But with the social distancing, okay, makeup industry was hit. Makeup is a very social habit. Mm-hmm. People wear makeup when they get dressed up, when they go out for dinner, when they go out to party, when they go to the office. Okay, and of course, wearing of masks hasn't helped that as well, because half of your face is covered. So when they looked at lip products, foundations, products like that, has really suffered. It's, you know, the eyes were still visible, so the eye makeup didn't suffer too much, but the makeup industry was hit. So obviously, we've been challenged over the last 18 months. Our business has fallen. But I guess, I mean, despite the economic and the, you know, the financial and the medical despair that's happened around the world, I would say for Tolly, COVID has probably been one of the best things that has happened.
Okay.
Why was that? You know, we could say we were busy fools. You know, we spend our life traveling all the time, chasing business, chasing customers, you know, either on a plane, customers coming to see us 2 or 3 times a week. And when COVID hit, all of that stopped. You know, we couldn't travel on a plane, nobody would come visit us. So our whole perspective changed to be much more internal. And focusing on systems, processes, structure, how we can change our business. And I believe in the last 12 months, we've changed the foundation, the structure of our business faster. It would have taken us 5 years in a normal period.
What kind of changes in practical terms?
I think focusing on strategy, focusing on rhythm, focusing on structures and processes, focusing on how we can be different.
One of the things I wanted to speak to you about, given that this is today, you know, a multinational company with people working in different, you know, parts of the world, communicating, etc. You've obviously worked with different teams, you know, different management teams, etc. What have this taught you about, you know, good leaders and good managers, like?
Good leaders and good managers. That's quite a big subject. I would say good leaders, they need to be passionate.
Okay,
really important. They need to be committed. They need to be able to communicate, but also they need to be able to listen. I always say that God gave us two ears, one mouth. So use your ears well and listen. Really important. So that's really what I would say around leadership.
And as you went along, apart from kind of what was happening on a customer-facing front, the company was always also changing in the sense that you've started. I guess the company was much simpler as an organization in the 80s. Today, it's again a multinational, so it's very, very sophisticated in that sense. What were kind of the main changes in building the right setup to be able to be what you are today?
Yeah, we grew pretty fast over a few years, and we got to around 50 million euros. And it was quite interesting because we got stuck at 50 million euros as a business. And a friend of mine who's a consultant came in, had a look at our business, and he says, well, you've moved from a flags to castle strategy. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, you, your father, you put flags everywhere. You put a flag in the US, flag in France, flag in Asia, China, Korea. And then you built castles, and you employed people to run those castles, and they were judged upon growing the business and profitability. But they did it independently. He said, and what happened is there's no aligned strategy, so you got stuck. He said, what we need to do, and that's what we did the last five years, is knock down the walls of the castles and instead build one big castle and have a much more aligned strategy. And in fact, that's another thing on leadership. People need to be aligned to the core values of the business. And so we've really changed the rhythm of our business. We've changed the alignment of the business and trying to move everybody in the same direction. Okay. And I think with some of these moves, with the change in the strategy, with the innovation center, from 2014 to 2018, we really grew our business. We doubled our business to hit 100 million euros in sales.
Only in the last 2 years?
Yeah, 2014 to 2018. Obviously, COVID, we've been hit, so we now need to rebuild.
Exactly. Aligning people with the strategy of the company when you have people all over the world. How do you do that in practice, in terms of meetings, you know, technologies? How do people, you know, meet, and what HR, you know, elements do you have in place? That's what I mean.
Well, I think the main event of the year was always the best was the annual sales meeting in January, where everybody used to come together, all the cultures. I always say we're one family, but made up of different cultures, the Tolly family around the world. People are really missing that face-to-face interaction. So what we've tried to do is create events online with the culture. So we do a lot of vulnerability-based sharing, which is quite interesting.
What's that?
So it's trying to be vulnerable with each other, to understand each other. You know, if you look at yourself, you're like an onion, trying to peel back the skin of the onion to get to the core. Because I think management theory, certainly in the West, is if we can understand each other better, then we can work better together, if we understand what makes us tick. But that's very easy to do that in the US. That's easy to do it in some parts of Europe, you know, the UK. As you get, you know, to France, to Germany, people are much more closed. They don't like to be vulnerable. And if you go to Asia, then it's almost impossible. You know, you're taught in Asia, you must not talk about, you know, your personal issues. You can't be vulnerable. So it's quite a challenge to be able to do that. But we have managed to create that kind of
the kind of positive climate in the company,
yes,
that allows for these kind of things, even like you said, because you have so many different cultures. I guess even on a client front, no, you're dealing with people from different cultures, and you know, or are people in these multinationals in the cosmetic industry all kind of, you know, from the same culture in the end, or is it not the case?
No, there are some of the big groups that are multicultural. You know, you might be on a conversation, you have people from the US, from Europe, from Asia, in the same teams. But I would say that generally the cultures are different. You know, you can start off in Japan, where people are very precise, very detailed, very focused. Yeah, you can have a great meeting, and you think you've sold something to them. Okay. They're just being polite. They'll never buy from you. You know, you have no clue.
And this has happened to you.
Absolutely. I remember going to do a presentation for one of the big brands. There were 40 people. We were there for 2 hours. I did a fantastic presentation. I said to my Japanese partner, "We've got them hooked." And he said, "Oh, no, they're just being polite." He was right. They never bought anything from us. And then you go to Korea, you go to China, even across Asia. It's a bit like Europe. You know, every country is different.
Within Asia.
Within Asia and within Europe as well. I would say you know, if you go to the brands in France, again, they're a bit more like the Japanese. They're very focused on specification, details, quality. And then if you go, you know, other parts of the world, a bit more relaxed, to be honest. Okay.
Tolly has done this great transformation from a purely manufacturing company to a service provider, if you like, for the cosmetics industry. But obviously Malta still has, you know, a manufacturing industry, you know, of a traditional form, even though that is changing a lot. What are the challenges, you think, for manufacturing in Malta? What shall we do to retain a degree of manufacturing?
I would say, if I look at us, the challenge that we have is that we have no customers in Malta and we have no suppliers in Malta. So we have to bring in all the raw materials, we convert, and we have to export. So it's availability of resources, really important, raw material resources as well as human resources. So as Malta boomed the last few years, a lot of third-party nationals came in. There was availability of resources to help us fuel this growth. Obviously, with COVID, that's changed. So I think one of the concerns everybody has today is, do we have enough resources? How are we going to get the resources to be able to recover, to refuel our economy? So that's a challenge. I always say that don't look down on upon ourselves as being Maltese. I think we've got fantastic creativity here on this island. And Tolly's a great example. What we're doing is we're taking our entrepreneurial spirit and we're implanting it in the four corners of the world. We're not asking for people to help us. We're doing it ourselves. We're going out there. We're not asking governments to help us introduce to customers in California or in China. You know, we're building structures, employing people, going out there, being pioneers and trying it ourselves. And I believe that anybody can do that. We're a small island here in Malta, but let's not look internally. Let's look externally.
Indeed.
And say the world's our oyster. You know, we're a nation of traders. You know, we're a nation of entrepreneurs. Let's go and take that entrepreneurial spirit ourselves and do that the same.
Great. Back to Tolly, I wanted to maybe reflect a little bit upon, you know, this is a 50-year-old company approximately. You know, I guess you had a number of, you know, setbacks and failures in the past. You know, what were the main ones and how did you deal with them before we kind of start wrapping up?
Yeah, we have had a lot of setbacks. I would say the first one was my father died when I was 27 years old. Okay, so I was pretty young to take over as chairman and CEO. And within a few months when he died, UK exited the ERM, okay, and there was complete currency chaos. All the currencies went against us, and I said, we're never going to survive. Okay. Our business survived because the Malta pound was actually devalued by 10%, okay. And that kind of saved our business. Then we've been through quite a few crises. We've been through two Gulf Wars. Why were the Gulf Wars a crisis? Because people stopped traveling. The beauty industry has a lot of confidence when people travel through airports by duty free. Maybe today it's changed a little bit because of the digital world, but in those days it was really important. The economic financial recession, I guess nearly 10 years ago.
In 2008.
You know, that really affected us. There was a knee-jerk reaction from customers. They thought the world was ending and nobody would buy anything. So they just turned off the taps, turned off the pipeline, and you had to find a way to survive. We invested in markets which didn't work out, like India.
Okay.
We had a big investment there.
What happened there, for example?
That's a long story. You need another half an hour for that story. But basically, we invested in India. We invested in South Korea. South Korea's been a fantastic success for us. India just didn't work out. I think the bureaucracy of dealing over there, really tough. The market probably wasn't big enough for what we were trying to offer. So that took a lot of management effort. As soon as we stopped that, refocused, we were able to set ourselves free. And again, the last crisis in COVID has been a crisis where I think for the first time we really managed this well by going in from a position of strength without panicking and finding the right way, you know, keeping up the communication.
Yeah. Because I guess you learn also as you go along to manage crisis. What would be, you know, your words of advice to them in kind of in general, in what you've experienced over the last many years and how, you know, they should approach taking a company international?
I think, first of all, dream big and aim high. Okay. Love what you do because you spend so much time at work doing what you do. If it's something you don't really like, then change. As I said earlier, we might be here in little Malta, but we're part of the European Union, which is a massive market. We're part of the world. So take our entrepreneur spirit and go out. The other thing I would say is work hard. Okay. Nothing is easy. Life doesn't come easy without hard work. I think anybody that is successful, really works hard. So I encourage people to focus, have discipline, work hard. And I'd say the final thing is about being agile. We just saw that the world changed very quickly. During the crisis, I said for Tolly, life is not about waiting for the storm to pass, but instead it's learning how to dance in the rain.
Okay.
That's all about being agile, being different. I like to end maybe with Charles Darwin's quote that says, It's not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent. Instead, it's the one that's most adaptable to change.
Exactly.
And for Tolly, for me, nothing is more important. You've got to dynamically steer the business. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You've got to find a ways to keep that agility, keep moving, keep looking forward.
In this series, we talk to experts and entrepreneurs on leadership and management issues. We have episodes on emerging out of a crisis, driving innovation, the digital imperative, attracting talent, seizing key opportunities, and the leadership lessons we can learn from the world of sport. The series also includes 4 interviews with international entrepreneurs based in Malta. International Insights was originally recorded for Trade Malta and made possible thanks to HSBC.